I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. Today, Russian President Vladimir Putin declared the annexation of four regions in eastern and southern Ukraine, Donetsk, Luhansk, Kherson, and Zaporizhzhia, illegally making them part of Russia. This was after a widely discredited vote in support of joining Russia with reports of threats and violence and coercion. This move complicates a seven-month war in Ukraine where the Ukrainian military has prevented Russia from taking over the country and has had some key victories in recent weeks. Could Russia be losing the war? Putin, who has called the war a special military operation, just called for the conscription of some 300,000 soldiers, resulting in protests and tens of thousands fleeing the country. Yesterday, Putin went on state television admitting that some mistakes were made and some of the men had been wrongly drafted. The U.S. and the EU have denounced the referendums and voted to increase sanctions on Russia. Well, today on Radio Times, we talk about the war in Ukraine and Putin himself. And we have two guests who have joined us. Tom Nichols, a staff writer at The Atlantic. He's also a professor emeritus at the Naval War College. And he joined us by Skype. And Tom Nichols, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And also with us, Michael Kimmage. He's a professor of history at Catholic University, a fellow at the German Marshall Fund. He served in the State Department during the Obama administration, where he held the Russia-Ukraine portfolio. He's got a forthcoming book to be called The Abandonment of the West. And Michael Kimmage, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Very nice to be here.
We have a lot to discuss, and let's talk about the news this morning. The annexation, the illegal annexation of parts of Ukraine, now made part of Russia, according to a decision and an announcement by Vladimir Putin this morning. To you, Tom Nichols, how does this change the conflict?
Well, this is Putin intentionally backing himself into a corner. He's trying to make the case now that people in these four areas are Russian citizens, that this is Russian territory, and that instead of this being an aggressive war of invasion and conquest, which is how he began it, he can now try to turn that around and say, I am fighting a defensive war to protect Russia. And that means that opens the door to even more conscription, and more importantly, to more nuclear threats.
And Michael, I want to read a quote. This is actually from the New York Times, and this is the quote-unquote election or the vote to join Russia. Someone, a man named Pavlo, who lives in a town in the Kherson region, said, and this is a quote, "When they first came to our town, they beat me up and took both of my cars." This is talking about the Russian soldiers. "And now they threaten that if I don't vote, they will evict me and my family from our apartment." He goes on to say that he did vote in support of Russia. Just how seriously should we take this vote, this referendum that was held this week?
Oh, it's easy to answer this question. We shouldn't take it seriously at all.
Okay.
It's merely the political theater that accompanies a set of entirely different military and political objectives that have been devised in the Kremlin. But the referenda is pure theater.
Is it also a distraction from the fact that Putin has been losing, or Russia has been losing on the battlefield, Michael Kimmage?
I mean, to a degree, I think it's about messaging. Putin just gave a very long and fiery speech in Moscow, and they're going to have celebrations in Moscow and Russia about this. So it does change the very bleak narrative that Putin has been facing for the last couple of weeks and months. I think that there's another dimension to it, which is that this will legitimate a very, very different posture, not just toward Ukraine, but toward those countries that are supporting Ukraine. And of course, we have this murky event of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline this week. But I think, in addition to nuclear brinksmanship, I think you may see a strong uptick in very aggressive measures directed toward European and perhaps toward the U.S. population. And that will be justified as defense of the homeland, exactly as Tom mentioned a moment ago.
What do you mean by that? Be specific.
Meaning that, Ukraine will now be identified in Russia as not fighting for its own territory, but attacking Russia in a series of engagements that are ongoing around this enormous line of contact. And the countries that are supporting Ukraine will be identified as countries that are also attacking Russia. And in effect, Putin's speech today was a declaration of war against the United States, maybe not quite in those words, but, you know, that more or less. So a cyber attack on the American economy or something similar on the economies of Europe, or perhaps attacks on pipelines or things of that sort may, in Putin's eyes, now be justifiable. And he may be trying to justify those kinds of things to a Russian population.
Well, you're talking about an escalation there. Tom Nichols, let me go back to you, because it's clear, at least from what Ukrainian President Zelensky has said, that he's not going to, he doesn't recognize these parts of Ukraine as parts of Russia now. If he goes in there, what do you think will happen?
Well, that's the ultimate question. What Putin is trying to do is deter any further advances by the Ukrainians to recapture their own territory by basically waving a magic wand and saying this is now the great patriotic war against fascist invaders. Putin, I wrote some months ago, Putin's spoiling for this to become a NATO-Russia war because he can't – it's too humiliating for the Russians – for Putin and for the Russian military to say that they lost to a middle power, a third their own size. He needs, if he's going to make any rationalization for this whole disaster, and let's remember this whole thing has happened because of one man's insane, you know, demented scheme to take over another country. he needs to now say, this really was always a war by the West against poor Russia. You can see it in his speech today. He, you know, this paranoia and inferiority complex, and you know they just don't learn. They can't leave us alone. You know, we just want to live in peace and protect our people. Mm. And so this, you know, this turns it from I am liberating people from Nazis to I am standing on the front lines of Russia itself defending against invaders. And he's hoping that that narrative is going to fly, not just, I think Michael's right, this is aimed at, you know, a lot of Americans and Europeans, where Putin now bares his teeth and says, listen, it's a different kind of war now. This is Russia. He's hoping we accept it. But I think he also wants to sell that at home. Because you're hearing guys calling, and I would recommend to people that they take a look at the piece in the New York Times yesterday with these snippets that were captured of, you know, guys calling home and saying, I don't know why I'm here. I don't understand what this war is about. I don't know why I'm having to do this and suffer this way. And he has a real problem on his hand. And this is a big attempt to kind of turn that ship around, and that's going to be hard to do, but he it's a pretty daring move.
Well, and I do want to quote from that New York Times article, Tom, that you just referenced, but Michael, let me go back to you, because Putin has threatened, it seemed, the use of nuclear weapons, maybe tactical nuclear weapons. How seriously should we take that?
Well, I think, to be sure, we should take it very seriously, simply on the level of language. I think we're kind of beyond any of the points where we were during the Cold War, and the Cuban Missile Crisis was scary enough, but it didn't have this public dimension. So obviously, it's a big issue. I mean, I think it's a very, very bad option for Putin, and could likely push much of the world into a kind of global coalition against Russia, a greater global coalition than currently exists, and that could potentially include China. So this might be really the way that Putin would lose the war, would be to resort to the nuclear option. And I suspect that he's aware of it, but his willingness to threaten, and he keeps going out further on this limb, is definitely worrisome.
Tom, how do you see that rhetoric, that threat?
I see it the same way. I think he probably understands that if he uses a nuclear weapon, then yes, it is a game changer, but it basically puts Russia against the entire rest of the world. Which I think, and you know, at this point, trying to get inside Putin's head is just a tough thing to do, and a scary place to be. But I think he's trying to gain the maximum effect from those threats. But I think if not him, there are plenty of people in the Kremlin who understand that exploding the first nuclear weapon, no matter how small. I mean, there are people out there, I think, on both sides trying to make the case that, well, what if it's a very small, what if it's a, you know, one kiloton? It doesn't matter. Once you've split the atom in anger again, 75 years later, it's going to be it's going to change the world. We will be living in a different world. And I think Putin probably understands that. What else has he got? This war is lost. I mean, he has bungled this beyond. I can't speak for a lot of my fellow Russia experts, but certainly astonished me. I was one of the people that said this thing isn't going to go the distance. Three axes of advance, three times the size of the country that's being invaded. And it's just been an incredibly bungled and strategically inept operation. And so annexing the territory and saying, I'll now just rely on nuclear threats is pretty much all he's got at this point.
Well, Michael, picking up on that, if he hasn't lost the war, is he losing the war? And are we talking then about a cornered Putin? This was the war that he chose to fight.
Well, I think I might give a slightly different answer from Tom's. I very much agree that in terms of Putin's core political objectives, some kind of control over Kiev, a kind of puppet regime, partitioning the country, half and half, I think that that's all way out of Putin's reach. And has been, to be sure, a senseless and criminal war from the outset. But I'm not sure I would quite say that he even is losing or has lost. I mean, he controls, or rather Russia controls, a little bit less than 20% of Ukraine's territory. They have a naval blockade that's strangling the Ukrainian economy. Mobilization is going to be chaotic and may pay few dividends, but if they pursue it over the course of several years, it could change the dynamic. And I think Putin feels, I suspect he's wrong about this, but I think that he feels that in some ways time is on his side, the sort of proverbial Ukraine fatigue of Europe and the United States, that if he can drag this war out for 2-3 years, that Western support will really diminish over time. I'm not making that prediction. I think it's a low probability outcome. I think it's a terrible strategy, but I think that's in his mind, and that's why for Putin, he hasn't lost yet in his own view.
A minute before our first break here, Tom, but I mean, is that, do you see a war of attrition that just goes on for years where each side wears each other down? And of course, we're watching the destruction of a country, Ukraine.
Well, I think I would have been more inclined to agree with Michael probably 2 or 3 months ago. I think after the shock wore off of realizing that they weren't going to be greeted as liberators and Kiev was going to fall and that the Ukrainian military is actually pretty competent, I think Putin probably thought, the slow strangulation and the war of attrition would work in his favor. I think one of the reasons he's doing what he's doing now, including conscription and annexation, is that he's concerned that time is not on his side, that the longer this goes on, I mean, he doesn't have another 2 years to make it through this. And I think he's decided that the West is going to flood this place with weapons that are all, I mean, in some sense, are already there. The battles of the winter are already provisioned up in Ukraine, and he knows that. And I think he thinks he's running out of time to accomplish something. And it was interesting in his speech. He said, "This
I gotta
is a
jump
done
in,
deal,
Tom,
and this is what
sorry,
we're
got to jump in. We're almost up on a break here, talking about Vladimir Putin, the war in Ukraine. Stay with us. We'll be right back."
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Aim. We are talking about the 7-month war in Ukraine, Putin's annexation of parts of Ukraine earlier this morning, protests in Russia against the draft, and the options facing Russia and the West as the fighting drags on. And again, talking with Tom Nichol, staff writer at The Atlantic, professor emeritus at the Naval War College. Michael Kimmage is with us as well. He's a professor of history at Catholic University, a fellow at the German Marshall Fund. He was in the Obama State Department, where he held the Russia-Ukraine portfolio. Tom, I had to jump in and interrupt you only because we were up in a break, but you were talking about Putin's speech this morning. Just finish your thought.
Simply that I think he thinks time is running out for him. And his speech this morning was really, I mean, even by the standards of some of his worst speeches, it's pretty unhinged stuff. And I think it's because he feels he's losing, and that enough American weapons, NATO weapons, you know, German, European weapons are making their way into Ukraine. And that the I think he's made a different calculation about whose side time is on and realizes it's probably not him.
Michael, Putin promised the Russian people a short war, that the victory would be easy in Ukraine. He doesn't even call it a war, a special military operation. And yet here he is calling up something like 300,000 soldiers to, I'm assuming, go to the front to go fight this war. We're seeing people, men leaving this country. We're seeing protests. Is this blowing up in his face?
I think that that's an overstatement. I mean, I think, first of all, the number 300,000, that may be a low estimate. It was an officially announced number. It seems like the number that they may truly be aiming for is closer to a million, but those are all, you know, sort of very rough estimates. I don't think it's blown up in his face yet. I think that one has to acknowledge that over the summer with polling data, and that was a time when the war was not going quite as badly for Russia as it is now, but the support for the war was between 70% and 80%. You know, take those numbers with a grain of salt.
Sure.
What Putin is trying to do is not just to mobilize the Russian military, but with the speech today and this very radical move of annexation, he's going to try to mobilize Russian society. It's a huge leap from where Russia was a year ago, and there's going to be resistance, and there has been already to the draft. There's been very little resistance in Russia to the war itself, and that may speak to the repressiveness of the government or to indifference of many people in Russia, but it's not an unpopular war yet. And I wouldn't say that Putin is an unpopular leader in Russia. He's gambling away some of that. He's risking a lot, but he's not at the stage of even being in political peril in some objective way. I mean, you can kind of see it on the horizon. But in that sense, the politics of the war so far has not blown up in its face. It's worked in such a way as to allow Putin to do whatever he's trying to do there. That's the reality up until now. You know, it's not going to last forever, but he's not in political danger.
But if you're going to call up a million people, that's a million different families. Do you think that will change the support for the war?
Absolutely. It brings the war home. It indicates to Russians who are saturated with government propaganda about the war. It indicates to them that the war is not going well. And, you know, it will raise very deep questions. It's, as Tom has said already, it's a war that Putin has not sort of justified or explained to the Russian people in comprehensible terms. And that makes mobilization all the more difficult. So he is definitely playing with political fire. And he will test the loyalty and support of his population in ways that have never been tested during the 20 years that he's been in power. So the dangers to him are absolutely immense, but at the moment there's still potential or hypothetical dangers.
Tom, you had referenced a New York Times article where they have transcripts of soldiers talking to girlfriends and mothers and fathers from the war. I'm assuming they've all been vetted here, but I'll just read a couple of them. And these are rather early on in the war where Yevgeny says, "We are positioned in Bucha town." Sergei says, "Our offense has stalled. We are losing this war. Half of our regiment is gone. We were given an order to kill everyone we see." Vlad says, "When I come home, I'm quitting. Screw the army. Putin is a fool." Alexander says, "He wants to take Kyiv, but there's no way we can do it." And goes on and on from there. Another soldier talks to his mother, saying 60% of the regiment is gone already. Yevgeny to a partner, "No one is left from my Kostroma regiment." Sergei to his mother, "There are 400 paratroopers. Only 38 of them survived because our commander sent soldiers to the slaughter." Now, these are individuals speaking, not necessarily representing all soldiers in Ukraine. But what does that tell us?
It tells us this is beyond normal military griping. You know, men in the field always complain, but these are guys calling home and saying, I don't know why I'm here. One of them, one of the quotes that jumped out at me in that piece was, "I've already become a murderer.
Yeah.
I don't want to kill anybody anymore. They've already turned me into a murderer. And when I come home, I just can't, you know, can't do this anymore." And it says that you're going to get a lot of these guys. Some of them are going to come home, but also that just telling people back home what's happening, this is inducing instability. back, you know, in the rear. And the thing about somebody like Putin is he seems invulnerable right up until the moment he isn't.
Hmm.
You know, this is the problem of every dictator, which is that it is inconceivable that they could be in any political danger right up until they have their, you know, Ceausescu on the balcony moment. Now, I agree with Michael. I don't think Putin's in that kind of danger, but there's between conscription, between these nuclear threats, there's a Russian journalist named Peter Pomerantsev who had a great line on this. He said, Russians fear Putin, but they fear nuclear war even more. And Putin may be trying to put fear into the hearts of Western decision makers, but I think he's succeeding in increasingly scaring his own people who really thought this was just going to be a lark. They thought it was going to be just a, you know, walkover.
Well, I'm picking up on that, Michael. Obviously, it's not a walkover. And are we talking about the second most powerful military in the world, Russia, after the United States? Is that what we're seeing?
Does Russia have the second most powerful military in the world?
Yeah.
I think that it's demoted its status. I don't know to which number, but in terms of its conventional military capacity, it's dramatically less effective, I think, than many in the West and many in Russia, including Putin himself, expected. Part of that is morale, as you were just discussing. Part of that is, of course, corruption within the Russian military, so expenditures that are pocketed and don't go anywhere. And part of it is a leadership where Putin is now a dictator, and so he's consolidated in his own hands the role of head of state, head of government, and commander-in-chief. And he is not integrating these roles at all well. So he's overriding more sensible military opinion, and he's pushing soldiers into a war that I'm sure on the 23rd of February, none of them wanted to fight. It's just an absolute recipe for disaster. So I'm sure on paper, Russia remains a very formidable force. The nuclear power is not going to go away, but the conventional military is a walking disaster.
Let me read a couple of comments. One from Patty. My grave concern is that Putin cannot be stopped as long as he's alive. It seems to me that an uprising or a coup on the part of the people or his inner circle is unlikely. Given how very dangerous he is, this is all very terrifying. I don't believe he will hesitate to use nuclear weapons, and appeasement is a bad idea, recalling Neville Chamberlain. And Tom, just what are your thoughts back, or what are your comments back to Patty there?
Well, he has hesitated about nuclear weapons, and he has been careful not to get too close to NATO territory. I mean, in this sense, you know, deterrence and the NATO alliance is doing exactly what it was designed to do, which, you know, so far this war has been limited to the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. As to whether or not anybody in his inner circle can stop him, that's hard to say. I mean, I'm the Russian military, on the one hand, you know, I'm sure feels betrayed by all of this. on the other hand, they're living in a world they made because of that corruption. A lot of the stuff that these guys were supposed to be, you know, armed and clothed and protected with, you know, did end up in people's pockets. So on the one hand, I'm sure they're feeling, you know, that they didn't want to be involved in this, and that they're feeling pretty raw about Putin. On the other hand, there are people in the military who are pushing Putin to be even more hardline than he is. Right. I think people need to understand Putin is not the hardest line guy there is. There are other people around him who are probably telling him to just, you know, go all in. And some of those are military guys who feel the need to recover their honor, because the Russian military, Michael was probably too polite to say it, they're not the second most powerful military in the world. They're not even the second most powerful military in Europe anymore. You know, they really have fallen. They are a, you know, third rank military with nuclear weapons at this point.
Which is still scary. And that is Tom Nichols. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic, professor emeritus at the Naval War College, joining us along with Michael Kimmich. He's a professor of history at Catholic University, a fellow at the German Marshall Fund. He served in the Obama State Department, where he held the Russia-Ukraine portfolio. And we are talking a lot about Vladimir Putin and the war in Ukraine. And you can join us by emailing us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Michael, in preparation for the show, I was doing my homework, doing some reading, and some journalists were writing about the fact that, you know, a lot of people, not just people worried about being conscripted, but a lot of Putin critics have left the country. Does that leave Putin surrounded by more yes men and yes women?
Well, there are a few yes women in the Russian government. It's mostly yes men,
yes,
and he's been surrounded by them for really quite a long time. So that, in terms of governance, is not a function of the war. That's the kind of government that Putin has set up, and it's sort of gone gradually from a highly authoritarian government to a dictatorship, where everybody is now sort of publicly forced to participate in these rituals of sycophancy. So that's, you know, worrisome in its own right because of the effect it probably has on Putin's psychological health or his ill health. It is an interesting dynamic. It's sort of not what one is familiar with from the Soviet Union, that the borders have still stayed open even after the mobilization drive was begun. And I think that's clearly a calculated move, that Putin is willing to accept the brain drain, which has been horrendous for Russia over the last couple of years and is in fast, very, very fast motion at the moment. He's willing to accept that because the people who leave are the critics, or they're the ones who might organize young people in Moscow and Petersburg and by doing so threaten his regime. So he's sort of put that release valve into Russian society, and you've seen, you know, just huge numbers of people run for the doors in the last couple of months.
To you, Tom, and I guess I'm asking both of you to get inside Putin's head, which is an unfair thing to do, but nonetheless, when he is criticized, when his actions are condemned, when we see, you know, war crimes being committed in Ukraine, does he care? Does that in any way hurt his status in his own country?
He cares in that he's very thin-skinned, vain, and somewhat emotional person. I think one of the mistakes that we made a long time ago was to buy into the image of Putin as this ice-cold, you know, chess-playing super spy. In fact, he's a thug. He's a gangster. And he's got a gangster's temper. And so, yeah, it matters to him when he is called out on this stuff. But does it matter at home? You know, it may, as paradoxical as it seems, some of that actually helps him at home.
A tough guy, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That, you know, he's like, yeah, hey, look what I'm doing. People are scared of me. And if they think I'm bad now, you know, wait till they get a load of what's coming. But again, underneath all of that was this implicit deal. I will only treat other people like that, not you. If you leave me alone, I will leave you alone in power. And that he's broken that deal now by the war coming home, the sanctions biting, conscription, all of that. So he's in a different world now.
Well, picking up on sanctions, and to you, Michael Kimmich, how harmful have they been to Putin himself and his allies, but also to the Russian people? Are they feeling them?
Not particularly harmful to either so far. I mean, really? The wealth of Putin's inner circle has been touched, but it's still, you know, quite large. Russian people, you know, have lost access to certain luxury goods, but they're not immiserated by the sanctions. Not really the goal of the sanctions. And, you know, Russia is still making huge amounts of money, in part still from the West, with sale of gas and oil. And, you know, the revenue there has been flowing in pretty steadily since the beginning of the war. But it's important to note that the strategic goal of the sanctions is not to impoverish Russia, or even, I mean, if they could do this, they would try, but it's not really doable. It's not even the goal of the sanctions to change Putin's overall calculus. That's sort of out of reach of the sanctions. The goal of the sanctions is to degrade Russia's medium to long-term military capacity. And I think that that's already kicked in. You know, it's hard to get software, it's hard to get microchips, it's hard to get parts, and that's going to become much, much more difficult over the winter and over the next year. So if what I said earlier is true, that Putin wants a long war of attrition, the sanctions are going to play a very important role in this and are going to be a real obstacle to Putin, because his military could deteriorate even further because of all the constraints that have been placed on it. But it's not, I think, fundamentally about the people or the power structure. It's really about the military capacity.
And Tom, I'd be curious about your response to that. Let me just add on top of that, what does then Ukraine need to be able to fight off Russia and even win this war in Ukraine?
Well, first, I agree that the sanctions are about making sure that the Russian state can't just allocate money at will to military power. I'll take a slight dissent here and say one thing the sanctions have done is to remind Russians that they are actually very much integrated into a global economy that the West and its allies were able to basically turn off in about 96 hours. And you saw that again in some of these discussions with, you know, the service people and their parents. I think one guy's girlfriend said something like, you know, Amazon, we can't, you know, Amazon is gone. And, you know, pretty soon we're not even be able to get any damn Coca-Cola.
Oh my gosh. Amazon, you know, and Coca-Cola in Russia. I hear you.
You know, which is a message to them that, no, you know, this wasn't, once again, that, you know, Putin promised you this was going to be a tidy little thing that was going to make Russia even greater. And, you know, now you know, your credit cards don't work. But in terms of the longer term sanctions, I think that's exactly right. And what Ukraine is getting is not just material. They're getting experience. They're getting, you know, the Ukrainian military performance was good at the start, and it's getting better. This whole counteroffensive was actually a really well-planned, strategically well-executed thing. And I think part of what motivated Putin to do what he did today with the annexation is he's worried that another offensive is going to threaten places like Kherson. I mean, he's looking and saying, wow, you know, these guys actually are on the move pretty fast, and now I have to plant some flags in a big hurry here. And the more stuff that comes into Ukraine, the more things like HIMARS and other systems that are going to make Russian offensives at all difficult and threaten their supply in the rear. That war of attrition is not on his side.
And that is Tom Nichols, who joins us along with Michael Kimmich, talking about the news out of Russia, the annexation of parts of Ukraine, the war in Ukraine. Much more to talk about after this very short break, including the pipeline sabotage. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and if you are just joining us, we're looking at this question, is Russian President Vladimir Putin losing the war he started in Ukraine? We're getting an update on the 7-month conflict. Talking about Putin's decision this morning to annex parts of Ukraine illegally, I should add. There have been protests in Russia against the draft, and there's much going on in this very important part of the world. Again, talking with Michael Kimmich, professor of history at Catholic University, a fellow at the German Marshall Fund, and Tom Nichols, staff writer at The Atlantic, also professor emeritus at the Naval War College. You can join us. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can call that phone number 1-888-477-9499. Just recognizing two of our listeners, Paul and Ronald, still very concerned about the fact that Putin is threatening the use of nuclear weapons. So I'll just put that out there and we can come back to that. But let me talk about the fact that winter is coming. Europe has been dependent on Russian fuel to make it through the winter. We're talking about pipelines. And this past week, there was some kind of sabotage, blowing up some pipelines in the Baltic Sea. Michael Kimmich, there's what much we don't know. But what is the significance, do you think, of that?
Yes, you're right that there's a great deal we don't know. I will, you know, sort of acknowledging that, say I think that it's pretty clear that this was a Russian initiative. It sort of figured interestingly in Putin's speech today, where he blamed it on the United States. So it's part of a narrative, and I think it's probably best interpreted at the moment as a shot across the bow. And you know, I think that we sometimes get a bit distracted by the nuclear question. I share the concern of the people calling in, for sure. It's a key question. But I think that what Putin will try to legitimate through the annexation of these territories of Ukraine is attacks on critical infrastructure. And I think by, if we assume that he did it, if the attack, you know, the attack on the Nord Stream 2 pipeline is just to say Russia can do this, can sort of do this at will. And as you say, the winter is coming.
Yeah.
You know, 25% of European gas comes from, I think, a single pipeline that runs from Norway to other parts of Europe. And if that would be attacked, you know, I think then Europe could be plunged into a kind of, you know, very immediate chaos. And, you know, that's the kind of stuff that Putin is playing with as possibilities. And that's what he's using also to intimidate. I think he wants to instill fear in the populations of Europe, and by doing so to drive a wedge between the United States and Europe. So that's how I interpret the Nord Stream 2 episode.
How do you interpret it, Tom? And is it possible for Europe to break its dependence on Russian oil and natural gas?
Well, it's at some point, the question isn't whether it's possible, it's necessary, but it's not going to happen anytime soon. It's certainly not going to happen in time to affect the outcome of this conflict. And I suspect, you know, again, we don't know how this happened or who blew it up. But I think, you know, again, this is Putin basically saying, I can hold you hostage in many ways, with energy, with nuclear weapons, you know, with this assault directly on the international order. It's interesting that Putin is trying to instill this level of fear in the rest of the world, because what it really reveals is how terrified Putin really is.
Terrified of what?
Of losing control of his own country, of humiliation in a war. you know, Russian leaders who screw up this badly don't usually get a medal. They get sent off. And I think he's really worried about that. I think he is, and I think, but also his personality, you'd mentioned earlier about trying to get inside his head.
Yep.
His personality is about getting a bigger hammer and blustering. Historically, he does back down eventually. But this, I think he's gone for all the marbles. And I wonder, you know, this goes back to speculation that was out there back in February. You know, does he believe his time is limited on Earth? Is he ill? Does he feel like, you know, he's reaching, I mean, he's 70 years old, and especially for a Russian male, that's, you know, pretty advanced age. There's something going on where he simply decided this is the time to cement his legacy. And he's invested in this, and with each disaster, he's doubled down over and over and over again. And I'm not sure even he knows how to get out of it at this point.
And thinking about the sabotage, though, Michael, Russia depends on revenue from its oil and gas. And if it is, you know, sabotaging or blowing up these pipelines, is it not going to hurt the Russian economy?
It will, but, you know, Russia in the scheme of things has other markets. I mean, China is buying a lot from Russia in this regard. And, you know, they have some alternatives. You know, gas is tricky because it runs through pipelines, and so it takes a while to redirect. But I think that's not a huge concern on Russia's part, and they'll sort of live with that. And I think they also just see the handwriting is on the wall. As Tom said, Europe feels it's necessary to separate itself from Russian gas and oil. So if that's going to happen 3 years from now, why not just force that on the Europeans in the next 2 months and make them pay the highest possible price for it? So the divorce between Europe and Russia is truly inevitable. And I think what Putin is exploring is, how do I make that divorce as profitable as possible? How do I use it perhaps to push the populations of Europe against their governments and cause them to question support for Ukraine and try to shift Western policy from within? I think Putin sees quite a few opportunities there, maybe less so at the moment in the U.S., than in Europe. And, you know, energy, inflation, economics is one of the tools that he has.
Judy has a question. Tom, I'll toss it to you. She says, do you think China will reverse alliances and help stop Putin from nuking, or at least advise him how to move towards an exit ramp? How do you see the role of China?
I think the Chinese have actually been fascinated to watch this as a test case. For whether you can simply grab territory and an exit by force, because the Chinese have similar interests. But I think even China, I think if Putin resorts to the use of a nuclear weapon, I think even China says, you know, with Putin being a gangster, I always use gangster language. It's going to be like that line from Goodfellas. Now I got to turn my back on you. Now I got to walk away from you. And I think that that would be the Chinese response to that. And I think also what the Chinese don't want is a lot of instability in the world. The Chinese are about making money, high growth. I think the deal, again, Putin said, don't worry, I've got this. This is going to be over quick. And the Chinese said, great, happy to see it. And then it all fell apart like this. And now the Chinese are saying this doesn't look like it was such a good idea.
Michael, with the advantage of hindsight, do you think the Obama administration made a mistake when Putin annexed Crimea?
Well, yes. I mean, the mistake was not the failure to go to war with Russia over Crimea. I think that was just a non-option for many reasons. The mistake was broader, and you can sort of stretch it all the way from 2014 when the annexation occurred to the eve of the invasion in 2022. The mistake was not to recognize how significant this was. Yeah. This was really a major change, and Russia was, you know, sort of on the march in very, very new ways. And I think if there wasn't a great way of preventing the annexation of Crimea, I think there were many ways of imposing costs on Russia after 2014 that were sort of left unexplored. I wouldn't just criticize the Obama administration here. I think Europe also drifted back to business as usual with Russia by about 2016, 2017. And that was very, very costly. So, you know, it's really the ways in which the annexation of Crimea led to the 2022 invasion, failure to anticipate, failure to do more, failure to take it all more seriously. The annexation probably, as a practical matter, was unpreventable.
What do you think, Tom?
I agree. And I think that Crimea is always a bad example here because the recent history of Crimea is pretty complicated. It's mostly Russians. It was gifted from Russia to Ukraine by Khrushchev, which, you know, was an unresolved thorn in Russia's side when the Soviet Union fell. The Black Sea Fleet was a source of a lot of stress and conflict, and particularly because of the men in that fleet feeling like they were being whipsawed back and forth. So the Russians gambled that the Americans and the Europeans were going to say, this one's just too complicated and it's a fait accompli and, you know, there's just not a lot we can do about it. I think we should have reacted to that the way we're reacting now. We should have armed Ukraine a lot sooner. I think we should have imposed a lot harsher measures. I also think, in fairness to the Obama administration, they could not imagine that they would be followed by the Trump administration. There wasn't. I think that there were limits on what President Obama could do. But I think Michael's absolutely right. The Europeans as well said, yeah, this is a terrible thing, but it's complicated, so we're just going to get back to business as usual. And I think we're all paying the price for that now.
You're saying if there had been a President Hillary Clinton, we might be having a different conversation?
Well, I think if there had been a president, anybody but Trump, we'd be having a different conversation. Yeah, in the sense that there would have been a lot more continuity. I mean, the Russians, it could not be lost on the Russians that the president of the United States was attempting to blackmail Ukraine for his own political purposes. And I'm sure that was factored into a sense, not just about Trump, but about Americans in general, that the American, and here I'll blame Obama as well, that the Americans are just tired of Europe. They're tired of NATO. They're not interested in this. You know, we have a much freer hand here. I've been concerned about that ever since the supposed pivot to Asia announcement years ago in the Obama administration, which I thought was a tremendous mistake to say out loud. Pivoting toward means pivoting away. And I think the Russians over the years have come to believe that they had a freer hand to upend the international order than they really had. And I think they've been surprised to find that, no, millions of people around the world really do care about this international order and that they're actually willing to fight for it.
Well, Tom, just a quick follow-up, because Putin didn't invade Ukraine when Trump was president. He invaded Ukraine when Biden was president. So what does that tell us, if anything?
Well, he didn't have to. He was getting what he wanted out of a Trump. There was no point in rushing through and putting an administration that was already clearly trying to get out of NATO why would you interfere with that? Trump, I think Putin knew that. I'm sure Trump said that to Putin. And I think Putin said, okay, you know, we can bide our time here and let's see how much damage this guy can do first. And it would have been foolish because, as we've seen, what Putin's really done is reinvigorate the entire purpose behind NATO. Putin's going to come, God willing, you know, this conflict comes to some kind of end that isn't catastrophic. And Putin's going to be facing a NATO that is going to be 32 countries and includes Finland and Sweden. I think you would not have seen something like that, you know, under the Trump administration. We're finding now from, I think it's the Baker and Glasser book, Trump was really serious about getting out of NATO. And I think Putin understood that. And he thought, why, you know, for now, why get in the way of that? Let that play out.
We have a couple of minutes. And Michael, I do want to go back to you. You had the Russia-Ukraine portfolio. We haven't really talked much about Ukraine, which we know is being devastated by this horrific war, the millions of people who have been displaced, the destructions of the destruction of so many parts of the country. What do you see as its future?
Well, that's a hard question to answer apart from the discussion about the war. I mean, I think that there are two contradictory truths about Ukraine at the present moment, and I'll start with the starker one and sort of conclude with the brighter one. The stark one is that the war has been exactly as you said. It's been devastating in every respect to the people of Ukraine, the children of Ukraine, the environment, the landscape, the infrastructure of the country, and to the culture. And the attacks on archives and educational institutions. I mean, it just goes on and on, the list of crimes that Putin's government has committed on the territory and with the people of Ukraine. And I think, you know, much as we would want to see the country recover as quickly as possible, it's obviously going to be years, decades, and perhaps even generations to get past the trauma and fully to rebuild. So the tragedy of the war in Ukraine is there before our eyes, and you know, we can't look away from it. There are also ways, this sort of the second part of my answer to your question, there are just other ways in which the country has cohered, has stuck together, has, you know, suffered from pretty bad political leadership in many respects after 1991, but has a very fine leader in the figure of Volodymyr Zelensky and has performed extremely well on the battlefield, which shows many different kinds of strengths in the society, and people have also been volunteering to great degrees. So the future Ukraine is there, the Ukraine that will be in a sense, you know, sort of better, or, you know, sort of stronger, more together than the Ukraine that was there pre-war. And, you know, that's an equally remarkable story. So the tragedy and the sort of heroism, of Ukraine at the present moment are intimately connected. And, you know, we just have to hope that the heroism, you know, can sort of push forward and the tragedy will start to recede.
Indeed. Well, we do have to leave our conversation there. I so appreciate both of you joining us today in Radio Times. Michael Kimmich, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. He's a professor of history at Catholic University, fellow with the German Marshall Fund. He's got a forthcoming book called The Abandonment of the West. Tom Nichols, thank you very much as well.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And he's staff writer at The Atlantic, professor emeritus at the Naval War College. Well, to replay this hour, many more hours, go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under Programs. And you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.